Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today. Welcome back to the official Project Blue Book podcast, and I'm your host, Tara Bennett, a senior producer for Sci-Fi Wire. So we're over the middle season hump, and all kinds of stuff is going down in this episode. So let's get into it with our guests for this week. We dive into the Green Fireballs. I'm thrilled to welcome back a familiar trio this week with creator and co-executive producer David O'Leary.
Hi, how's everyone doing?
And Mr. Showrunner and executive producer, we've got Sean Jablonski.
Hello again.
And Michael Malarkey, who of course is Captain Quinn. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
All right. So I like to start with the case of it all. So let's talk about the Green Fireballs. So tell me about the choice for this to be the case for the emotional backdrop this week.
This is one of the seminal cases that Captain Ed Ruppelt talks about in his book as well. The Green Fireballs, just for audiences out there, were consistent phenomena, these mysterious green orbs of light, balls of light, seen over some of our most sensitive military bases, weapons testing facilities, primarily in the Nevada and New Mexico areas. Mm-hmm. And nobody really knew what it was or what we were dealing with. But I think what's so interesting about it was just that it was consistent and it was seen over and over and over again.
Mostly around military and nuclear bases. And that's what really sparked the largest interest, really. Yeah. And I think one of the other reasons we looked at this, too, was there was this actual program that was supposed to have taken place to capture these fireballs that we show Hynek doing, called Project Twinkle.
Yeah.
And it was these real cameras they were setting up that were going to capture the fireballs in the air so they could explain them. A lot of it was meteor showers, basically, is what they were saying. But the program got shut down before it ever got off the ground.
Yeah. So. And Project Twinkle, the idea of that was pretty revolutionary and ahead of its time. I mean, the idea was to set up this like matrix of cameras, which you see in this episode, that can sense motion and can sense movement in the skies that would then trigger photographs to be taken so you could track these things in real time and sort of build out a trajectory. So, and this is the late 40s, early 50s.
I know.
So it's pretty incredible.
When you're watching, they're going, really? You do go, this is really ahead of its time. I mean, this is stuff that we're doing now.
One of the things that they suspected, which we explore in the episode as well, was the theory, are we dealing with some sort of Soviet drone technology that is monitoring our weapons testing that we don't understand? And what's so huge about that is, okay, so that means that they're able to penetrate our nation's skies without our knowledge. And of course, we look into that in the episode because it's like, even if that was the case, or even if that turned out to be the answer, certainly like the American public can't know that we're that vulnerable.
Yeah.
And it lent a lot of credence that in reality, Twinkle was supposed to be put into operation and it got killed before it ever got there.
Right.
They took, it wasn't Hynek's word from it. It was another person. I can't remember the name, but basically said meteor showers and they went, great, okay. And so the opportunity to really get these photographs of these green fireballs never sort of came. And it was shut down, which again helps our storytelling because you go, what is the military really again is asking that this not get out to the public?
And one of the most different things about this episode is that because it was taking place over these bases, you were having multiple witnesses who were absolute professionals and scientists and Air Force people, weather people who were accustomed to seeing phenomena in the skies. And when Blue Book went down there, when Ruppelt went down there and talked to them, they were all thinking it was some kind of alien drones or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, they were all getting excited about that idea.
And that's cool because there is an instant credibility. You've got all of these military members and soldiers who are not PTSD sufferers. These are people that are in active duty that saw this.
They couldn't prove what it was either way, and so they did not release any of the information to the public because of that.
I have to say, this was one of my favorite cases because what you have on record and people actually testifying before Congress, this also happened in Russia as well, I think, in the 80s, when these things would appear over the bases, they would have a shutdown of exactly. all the power of these missiles. So obviously, you know, we took it the other way. A shutdown is not nearly as dramatic as launching one of these things. We're like, oh, somebody just flipped the switch.
Yeah.
But in terms of any evidence that you're looking for, again, documented, you can look it up, testified before Congress, these people, military men, trained observers to say, we can't figure this out.
And even in those cases of shutdown, sometimes the systems would have independent safeguards where, like, you can't shut down. You can shut down one, but you can't shut them all down. Yet they would, with the appearance of these mysterious objects in the sky, they would get independently shut down on command, like boom, boom, boom.
Wow.
So we just kind of took that concept, which is real and documented, and just ran with it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the aesthetic of the opening because it is so great. Ultimate visualization of the Cold War suburban, perfect little manicured neighborhood with all of these mannequins, and then the switch that this is a testing facility. Just the aesthetic of that is such a great, creepy, mysterious open. It touches on a couple little horror beats. So tell me about where that idea came from.
The green fireballs were always up on our board as something we wanted to do. And if you look at that footage of, you know, the early footage of the nuclear testing, we pretty much got that opening and went, okay, now we just have to build everything around here. And it's great later when Hynek and Quinn show up there and run into Michael Imperioli.
Yeah.
And, you
right.
know, I'm sure people might have caught this, but we use real people.
Yeah,
as mannequins.
I was just going to say.
So
yeah.
great.
And so, again, I think it leans into what the show is about, which is what are you seeing?
Yes.
You know, you're going to look and go, I swear those people
right.
are real.
So, yeah, because it's a mix of like really lifelike mannequins and then real actors that could do a really good job of standing still.
We did have to spend a few dollars to take out some blinks and breathing, you know, after.
We did. A couple of shaky hands, you know.
I got to say as well that makeup really killed it on that. I remember getting to set for the first time where all the mannequins were, and they just looked so gaunt, and they killed it. I just got to say. That's hard to do.
Yeah. It made me do, especially in the very beginning, I double-taked a couple times going, wait, they look too alive.
Real,
and then you'd see a shot where it was definitely one.
Right.
And then you go back, I'm like, oh, I see. This is good. Because it really works with the Imperioli when he runs.
All credit to Norma.
I was just going to say Norma did such a great job. And then it also allows us to play into sort of what's going on with Hynek's psyche at the time.
Yes.
So when he comes back to the base at night and he hasn't slept in days and he's like, am I imagining things? Am I hallucinating? And then all of a sudden the lights are blinking. He doesn't know what's going on. Are the dummies moving? Are they not? It just ends up working really well with what's psychologically happening with Hynek at the time, too, that it's this weird kind of creepy horror film vibe.
And that's the perfect segue because I want to get into the emotional ramifications of what's going on. So in the last episode, we had Quinn and we had Hynek separate at that old amusement park. And then we have the whole Fuller sequence where he self-immolates and it's terrifying and awful. And that is the repercussion. Alan is not in a good place. He's had 2 weeks of seeing death in an awful, awful way, trying to process it. As he says in this episode, I just want science to prove some truth so I don't have to kind of live in this space of not knowing, because that is awful to him. Coming into a partnership at this point with episode 6, we have had more of an embracing of, hey, we have to trust each other. We have to be on the same page. But this is another separation moment for the two of them. Tell me a little bit about psychologically where you and Aiden wanted to play his desperation in this moment.
Yeah, well, one of my favorite scenes in the episode is when I'm confronting him hovered over the desk and saying, you know, you haven't slept. I see a man who's on the brink, et cetera, and he lashes back. And I think, you know, there is 2 weeks or something between the episodes. And in that time, I've seen him starting to dwindle as Quinn is very adept at analyzing where someone's head's at. He's starting to worry that this could start to be a liability. But the cool thing is that we're both on side and, you know, in some weird way, I've started to care about this guy.
Yeah.
And I think we see that. I wouldn't take as much time to try to get him to chill.
Yes.
if I didn't care. And I think the thing about Quinn is you can't see everything he's thinking all the time, but it comes out in his actions and what he's doing. He's very guarded.
And speaking of actions, there's a moment when the secretary comes in and holy cow, Quinn jumps too. It's like you really are reminded because you have this kind of casual way about your investigating and how you carry yourself. And that is like we are reminded in a heartbeat that you are a military guy. And that really pulls into the idea that Hynek has really created a chain of command problem by going around Quinn. there's a betrayal, and like you just said, you care about him, but he has done something that could put you in a really bad situation.
Well, yeah, this is it. I mean, by going behind Quinn's back to Fairchild, it basically reflects extremely badly on Quinn, and all of this stuff is danger territory. And the great thing about it, though, is that when he enters the room, and any time he talks to the generals, you see, because Quinn is very in control on the ground with Hynek. He's the boss, in a way. But it's nice to see that chain of command and how it affects him and what's at stake.
Hynek's really not thinking about protecting Quinn, which you would technically do in a situation where he really started to embrace a partnership. He's thinking about, what do I have to do to get some solace? And then this is what I'm going to do. So talk about making those choices for him.
This is a man in pain. This is a man grieving over the death of a young man. And he takes responsibility for that man's death in some way because he's unable to figure the mystery out and solve him. And, you know, this is the first real, in episode one, this is the first UFO witness that he really connects to and bonds with and starts to affect him in some way. So he's struggling with that. What I love about this episode is just how what he ends up doing is sort of repelling his quest for the truth and being like, forget it. It's too much. I'm towing the company line now. I'm going to prove it's meteors. Mm-hmm. I have this camera system that's going to show it. And so it's a really interesting shift as an emotional response to the trauma that we've seen at the end of 105.
Being just past the midpoint of the season, it felt like you, especially from Hynek's character, wanted to sort of shift that dynamic and raise the stakes. And we talked about that from the beginning, about the cases, the stakes are going to raise. We need to raise it with our characters as well. This episode especially, there's so much on the line because it's also the first real fracture in the partnership as well. And it's jeopardizing that. Hynek is feeling guilty about putting his family in danger. He feels guilty about this person that he could have saved that actually died. Mm-hmm. And so he is the manifestation of the amount of stakes that are happening, and it's driving him crazy. We needed to have him go through sort of dark night of the soul to figure out and make a choice. There was a lot of discussion, I remember, in the writer's room. I know especially those of us that have families, which I think is all of us. When you bring work home to the extent that you endanger your wife and child, how in good conscience do you continue to do that work? And so we go, well, we have to push him really far so that we and he and the audience understands that this is something he must do.
Mm-hmm.
When he finds the object at the end, it's taken him to a place where he can't get out now. And so we sort of force the hand in that way. And I think structurally, that's where we wanted to get to.
Let's talk a little bit about the Mimi of it all with this episode. We've never really seen Mimi or Hynek spending a lot of time together. We meet them at the beginning of the series, which is a separation point for them in terms of what her day-to-day life is versus him jumping into this whole project. And this is also a crisis point for the two of them, and she can make a choice to be mad or to be empathetic with him. So talk about what this means for them in their marriage at this point.
He's got the object, right? And he makes the choice of, I'm going to share something with you that I don't even really fully understand. And it's letting her in to a piece of the scope and the weight he's carrying on his shoulders.
Yeah.
It's a great performance by Lord. It's beyond what she expected.
It's doing two things for us, too. First is, like, the real-life Mimi Hynek became involved with her husband in the investigation of the cases and sort of educated herself. And so we wanted to lay a little pipe for that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also say that Hynek is married to two people. And so seeing the fracture in the relationship with Quinn was very important as well. And I think you see the difference in how Quinn reacts to Hynek and how Mimi reacts to Hynek and who he chooses to share this with.
Right. So. Absolutely. And opening that up. I wanted to talk, Michael, about working with Michael Imperioli.
Yeah, well, that's another favorite moment I have in the episode from Quinn's standpoint is when he comes out after that interview and says he's full of shit.
Yes.
And Hynek's like, how do you know? And I explain about his hands or whatever I say. I can't remember. You don't see Quinn necessarily picking up on all that stuff, but the fact that he does says a lot about his training.
Yes.
And anytime we see his training, it validates the whole thing.
Yeah.
Imperioli is a class act. I actually was very shocked and happy that he was cast because before I even became an actor, I was a musician and playing in a hardcore band. And the first series I ever binge watched was Sopranos.
Ah.
And that's before I was even interested in being an actor, really.
Wow.
So it was weird to meet somebody that I watched and respected from before I even trained. And it's just an honor to have him on the show. And he just always delivers. There's a lot more, by the way, coming up.
I had a feeling that you don't bring somebody of his stature into a show and have him in and out as quickly. But
I must say, also, the first thing I shot with him was the takedown. I basically was straddling him. the first day we met. So very strange full circle.
Hero and binge watch.
The beginning of a wonderful friendship.
We've all been there at the beginning of a relationship.
Right.
I'm going to tackle you with my love.
I will say, just to tee up, I think it's some of the best performances coming up next week. And the interplay between, I think we can give this away, they're playing stuff on the air, teasing it, but between Michael and
Michael.
Michael and Michael, right? Michael. I'm literally going, am I talking about your character, Michael? And
right.
Then,
for
you,
so
Michael, there's a lot of Michael.
What do I do?
But yeah, I really, we've talked about this. It's just, it was some of my, if not my most favorite thing to watch with him on screen.
Thanks, guys.
Couldn't agree more.
No, when I saw it on the script, I was like, ooh, this is going to be
fun. Yay, that's good stuff.
We talk about bacon. That's not a spoiler, but see if you can figure that in.
I want some fan art with bacon now. That's what I want, guys. when you're looking for guest actors and you're basically pitching a character and saying, hey, here's a little arc. Are you interested or not? Was he always high on the, could we get him? Or like, was it a circumstances that came through casting?
I tend never to write for someone in particular because it's just, you just chase
you never
people
know.
And you just never know. We have the best casting,
Victoria
and Scott. They read it and immediately they came up and is like, Imperioli would be great for this.
Right.
And we were like, yeah, can we get him?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, sure. And then they secured it, and he thought enough of the role, too. And
they had so many good ideas along the way to help us. Yeah, they were wonderful.
I wanted to talk also about Susie. So she's had quite the trajectory as we head into this episode. We've got to see more about what she has agency over, what she doesn't with what she's doing in terms of the investigation. There's a pretty dark moment at the end of this episode in which she is tasked to do with that nosy neighbor.
Donna,
see, guys?
Donna.
You can bring your chocolate chip
hardly,
cookies all you want.
We hardly knew thee, Donna. But you stuck your nose where you don't belong.
This is trouble. Yeah, it's a good warning, guys. But yeah, you know, Donna was seeing her in all the wrong moments that put her into her own type of jeopardy. But Susie, it's really been interesting to see her struggle. We see that she is incredibly adept at being able to work whoever she needs to work in a moment, but we really are getting a sympathetic side of her, too.
For sure. I mean, there's, like, multiple things going on with Susie, right? Like, first of all, she's, like, sort of arguing with Cal, right, with Curry Graham's character, about is there a real intelligence value to what we're doing by infiltrating this civilian asset connected to this military program, which she believes 100% there is. She's learning that it goes deeper. It's not just about chasing lights in the sky. There's other programs going on that it connects to. So she struggles with that. Then she struggling with the fact that she genuinely, I think, is sparking up this friendship with Mimi as a sort of, that's her cover, right? But there's this shift there happening of like, there's a real friendship there.
One of the things we were very conscious of was the way they felt like they could honestly connect. These are two women at a time where they are sort of under the thumb, not just of society, but men, really.
Yeah.
I mean, we know how much that roles and values and perceptions of women have changed since the 50s. And so Susie is this operative who is one of the best at what she does, and yet she has this guy beating her around, you know?
Right.
And so it's a much more dramatic representation, we felt, of like how women were treated in the 50s. Mm-hmm. They were not seen as competent. They were shoved around. They were made to do things they did not want to do. And I always felt like Mimi and Susie were both sort of trapped in this environment, which made that connection honest.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
So it doesn't feel like it's just something they're playing. It's like they can connect on that.
And Michael, you get to play with Ksenia in this episode.
Well, I got to work with a girl.
Cool. It's a dude fest for you most of the time.
No, she's fantastic and a very giving actress. And yeah, that scene when he interrogates her at the home and then again at the office, it's a sea of subtlety. And I think the great thing from Quinn's perspective is he's initially quite suspicious. And when he finds out that she's the victim of some kind of abuse, it's almost like that all falls away. And he's, you know, Quinn's got a really strong moral code. As much as he's towing the company line, there's still a part of him that really cares deeply. That's even arguably where the Air Force is anyway. You know, they care deeply about the American citizens. But I think Quinn, on a personal level also, he's never really had a, well, who knows? But I think he's never really had a proper, steady relationship.
Yeah.
He's given his life to the Air Force. And we see a bit of that in episode 3 as well, when you go to the college campus and he's interested in this chick.
when he gets that midnight call from Hynek in this episode, he is alone. And
pitch at one point, like, painting in a woman next to
him. I was wondering if there was going to be ruffled sheets.
Yeah. You just need to see a shape, and you go, oh, he's with someone.
Yeah. Right. She could have been under the sheets.
Right. She could have been, It'd be a great,
I did look. I was like, what's under? Is there a duvet? Wait, no, he's all by himself. Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. Did he go home alone that night? Or was it a good night?
Well, this is it. I don't think it's a sad thing for him as much as it is just, it's his job. I mean, the times I've spoken with Air Force people and what I've seen is this intense love for the work.
Yeah.
It's almost a romantic love of, you know, this means everything to me. And you do give yourself to that a bit. And I think that's where Quinn's at. But once you see this Susie Quinn thing, you start to see, hang on, what's going on there? Mm-hmm. And maybe or maybe not, that's something we revisit.
I think David might remember this, what I said or what we said when we watched those scenes of the two of you guys together.
You said, there are gold in them hills.
Yes.
Their chemistry is off the charts.
Mm-hmm.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, you know, you don't waste that kind of goodness. No. Just like Michael Imperioli coming in. You don't waste him coming in when there could be more scenes with that. I wanted to talk to you, Michael, about at this point, you're six episodes into a new series. What are the things that you were really warming to that you loved that you were seeing that were coming in the scripts about who Quinn was and the things that you really enjoy opening up and fleshing out about him?
Well, I called up Sean one day before we shot Operation Paperclip and was like, hey, man, let me in on any kind of backstory that Quinn may have experienced so I can use that.
And
we kind of opened this channel of dialogue. I was initially kind of like, I'll just buckle down, do my job, work with the scripts. Then I was like, wait, what am I doing? Let's make this deeper. And he was very open with sharing where their heads were at with everything. And I think it's much more interesting if Quinn is flawed and has a bit of a disturbing past. And something that he's actually dealing with in his own way.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, you know, I think when viewers watch, they'll think he's a bit straight-faced, toeing the line and everything. But I think as these episodes unfurl, we start to see, oh, that's actually protecting him from becoming emotionally invested. Because when he does things like burst onto a base and can't help himself, bark things at Von Braun, or act in other ways, which we're going to see in the next episode, which he really crosses a bit of a line. And that's a bit of a teaser, not a spoiler.
Right.
And I think that's when characters get interesting.
There are some EPs that do not like to share anything with their actors because they want them to play the page and not go ahead of themselves. But in having that conversation as writers in the room and you wanting the collaboration from Michael and you also having an idea what you've crafted for his trajectory as a character, what did Michael bring to the page that helped influence how you wrote and vice versa in terms of just that melange of creativity and collaboration?
I can leave the room if you want.
Yeah. Can you step out of the room for a second, Michael? Okay, he's gone now. Here we go.
Here's the, you know, the grizzled veteran type thing, but it's been my experience that there is this inevitability where the longer you're on a show that you wind up absorbing not just the idiosyncrasies of the actors and the characters, but it's strange how there's almost this subconscious thing where I can't tell you how many times I've written a script on a show and an actor will go, this is so weird because this was a very similar experience to mine.
Yeah.
And I feel like you sort of pick up on that. And I feel like it's important to embrace that. If you want to keep people in the dark for a reason, I can understand that as well. I feel like I know I work better when you can kind of find it together. TV is a collaborative medium. An actor's going to get on stage and Michael jump in, but, you know, you're going to work with a director and you're going to bring your own ideas to it as well. We're just doing it sooner, you know, and it gives us both an opportunity to flush things out and get farther in the process, I think. Otherwise, you're waiting to watch dailies in a scene in a show to go, okay, I'm seeing a little thing, now I'll work with that. Whereas if we have conversations leading up to it, wow, that stuff's already going on the page and you get to push it farther. And
sometimes as writers, you're juggling, you know, multiple characters, but an actor gets to really sit with that singular character and really do the deep dive. And all the time, right, the actors will come up with things that help us.
You know, and the truth is that, and again, this happens every time on every show. It's like, you know, we sit with our version of the characters on the page for a long time, but they have to live it, right? And so it does nobody any good if it feels like you're imposing something on them. I feel like you really want to involve your actors. They're bringing as much to the table at the end of the day as you are on the page, so...
You guys never let me say bro, though.
Yeah.
Pretty bummed about
yeah.
that.
Not the vernacular of the 50s. You wanted to call Aiden my homie, and like we...
What's up, dog?
We had some issues with that. Maybe yeah, what's up, dog? Yeah.
Period accurate, but
well, I was going to say, there's nothing worse than getting onto set with your own idea of the scene and having worked on it and really fleshed something out for them to go, that's really not where we were going with that. And then you have to actually, within seconds, rejig your entire mental trajectory for the scene, you know? So, especially for important bits like that, I'm appreciative that the communication line was open.
Well, we're excited to see where that goes in the next episode. But I will end with one other big moment that happens in this episode. So there's a church.
Yes.
Oh, there's that.
I was hoping we wouldn't forget about, about that.
No. There's a church meeting, and there's an alloy of some kind that is found in a box based on that meeting. So tell me about that.
This is the moment that unseen is seen.
Is seen.
And I love how that scene came together. Ian Tracy, who's the actor who plays Unseen, is phenomenal.
Yes.
In the
X-Files days,
yeah,
he was on
too.
Yeah.
He's just so great, and he's so interesting to watch. Why has he reached out to Heineken in such a way? Why has he gone through such great lengths to get his attention?
Yes.
And now we begin to get the beginnings of those answers with the keys that he gives him, which, you know, because Heineken is the one who has access to the base, Unseen does not. And then, of course, the big revelation of this mysterious object, the artifact, as we sometimes would refer to it as.
There was an initial idea for it, and there's plenty of stuff you can read. I think Tom DeLonge's company talks about having this sort of metametal and stuff that's like unlike anything on this planet, which again, the show is about finding proof, and this felt like something tangible that we hadn't had yet. I will say this, it is not a one-off. It is something that has a longer life to it and connects to something till the finale. And so that, yes, that was actually a planned idea.
It's very mid-century modern. I feel like the Heineks could put it on a coffee table.
Yeah, right? Oh, quick note about that. I think I can share this. There's a moment where we're shooting in the house, and there actually is some artwork that Ross Dempster did independently of knowing that we were doing this with the object. It's just another weird synchronicity that looks a little bit like the object. So I encourage fans to dig that down, but that is just another one of the weird kind of pattern moments that sort of happens.
Start digging into some frames, fans. And we will round up the episode with that. I want to again thank you all so much for your time, David, Sean, Michael.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
We're excited to see where it goes.
Thanks so much.
And as always, I also have to give it up for my wonderful podcast team, producer Kirby Dixon, producer-editor Paul Terry, mixer and master Dave Draper, and thank you so much for LA Digital Recording for being our home again this week. If you're enjoying the show, please give us a review or subscribe. Positive reviews help the profile of the podcast and Project Blue Book. Thanks so much for listening. As always, keep watching the skies.